This episode of Section D first aired on the 24th of January 2012. Hello and welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's weekly design show. I'm Hugo MacDonald. This week we're celebrating birthdays, trawling fair stands, and eavesdropping on crowds as they gather in cities across the globe for the first round of design and fashion shows in 2012. We'll be kicking off with a round table discussion at the D&AD headquarters in London, looking back at 50 years of design and art direction.
I'm trying to say that creative ideas and creative agencies and creative companies can change the world and have a positive impact on the world. And really that's what it does. It's here is an award that says this is for ideas that change the world.
We'll skip across the channel from London to Paris to get the skinny on the autumn-winter menswear collections.
Everyone was slightly concerned. Winter's a big season, especially for us, because we do so many boots and chunky shoes and things like that. But the reaction's been really positive. And I think people are really interested in looking for new, interesting product.
And we'll continue our travels east to Beijing to hear how China's designers aren't all hell-bent on copying everyone else.
I found stories from 100 years ago where the French were all in arms because the Germans were copying the French. 30 years ago, Italy was the center of copying and fashion. So I think it's a mistake to think of this as some kind of permanent condition or some inherently Chinese thing.
Plus, we'll celebrate the 100th birthday of Danish designer Finn Yu. We'll hear about the favourite things of Gallery Creo's founder, Clemens Krentowski. And I'll deliver my top musings from the annual furniture fair in Cologne. That's all to come in this week's Section D. Stay tuned. Welcome one and all to Section D. And from one D to another, our first piece this week saw Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer Powell, take a short trip across London to the HQ of D&AD, which stands for Design and Art Direction. The London-based charity hosts an annual awards ceremony celebrating the very best of the UK's design and art direction. Pencils, black for the best and yellow for the very nearly best, are handed out and are some of the most coveted accolades in the industry. This year, D&AD is celebrating its 50th anniversary, and Richard sat down with the CEO, Tim Lindsay, executive, Andy Sandoz, and Linda Relf-Knight, former editor of Design Week and D&AD consultant. Richard started by asking Linda how the awards had changed over 50 years.
50 years, I have not been around for all of that time in the design business. I represent the design side, but it's changed phenomenally. When D&AD set up, as I understand it from those who are still around who were involved in setting it up, everybody was running little studios. It was very sort of cottage industry. Now we've got a bigger global business, still cottage industry on the one hand, but big global branding groups, big international product design groups, and people like Apple who are actually using design in a very effective way. So it's changed remarkably, and I think that that change in design is very well reflected in some of the winners of D&AD over the years. Andy Sandoz, who's here, has done a timeline on 50 years of design and advertising that has actually come through the awards. And if you chart the stuff there, you get a few really good stories there.
What the timeline does and what it really showed for D&AD is they were there at the transition from sort of radio to TV. They were there actually when paperback books started to appear and use their front covers to sell the stories within. Mm-hmm. They were there at the onset of early interactivity, of social communications, of all of these kind of trends, and not just the media trends, but more actually the trends in communication that came through that, and the way that there's different opportunities to tell stories, I think. And what the timeline really proves is the brilliance of D&AD for being at that moment and championing that for the year to come. And the premise in the timeline is, will you be there next year? Are you there to be judged? Can you write yourself into the future? And that's the strength of the awards for me, is they place a benchmark for everybody with ambition in any creative industry about what to achieve for greatness or what to achieve for excellence. And I think that's really important because everyone tries really hard.
Annually making a record of the best work from around the world that year is what we literally do in the D&AD annual. But the other great thing about DNAD is the wonderful people who've been associated with it in its, to date, 49-year history. And it really is just a roll call of the most talented people in advertising and design over that period. Either involved as president, which is a kind of elected, awarded creative person, or as a CEO or chairman. You know, Dick Powell of Seymour Powell is currently the chairman of DNAD. Rosie Arnold is the president this year, deputy executive creative director of BBH. Next year, Neville Brody will be president. And if you project all that back into the past, the most distinguished people in our broad industry have been involved with DNAD and still support it. And we intend in our 50th celebration to really honour them and the contribution that they've made.
So this inclusion of very established and highly regarded people as part of the allure of DNAD, I suppose it's that you want to be judged by the best people, you want to be associated with the best people, and that's part of the process of getting everyone from around the world to submit. Are you looking at potential economic challenges with the state of the world, with obviously you have to pay to enter, and just reverting back to technology slightly, how has technology affected the entries and the types of work that you're seeing? Because obviously 50 years ago, I imagine it's mainly sort of print and TV, but now we're looking at so many more things. I mean, we've often, you know, we lament the end of print because we're so much about print, but are you seeing fewer print entries?
Yes, if I can answer that. I mean, one of the challenges and one of the things that makes it, you know, kind of dynamic and exciting is evolving the categories to sort of reflect the reality of the business so that people are entering, you know, interactive work, stuff that's based on new technology. And DNAD actively, embraces the sort of emerging digital part of our business.
Yeah.
And I think has done it reasonably successfully. So, yes, absolutely, conventional print entries go down, but that's compensated, you know, in many other categories. And just referring to something you said a little earlier, absolutely, the strength of DNAD is the standard it applies. It doesn't have to give awards. We're a not-for-profit organisation. We're not compelled to give an award in a category if we don't think the standard is high enough. You know, getting a black pencil is just an unbelievable accolade.
Yeah.
And it's an accolade from your most talented peers. I mean, the other part of what makes it unique and appealing to creative people is the quality of the jury members. And this year, the 50th, we've got the most unbelievable jury foreman and jury members, you know, coming from all around the world to judge the work.
I was going to chip in on that technology point, actually. For me, like, the, what was it, 15, whatever, the press, that was technology, you know, and that came along and movable type. And so was paper, I guess, paper manufacturing and mm-hmm. colour photography. And all of that is technology, and it's no different than iOS or if-then-else statements in code. All of it is the same thing, which is a medium for storytelling through creativity, writing, pitches, interaction, all that kind of stuff. So whilst I think there is going to be a natural down curve in print to some degree, I would also imagine that there is probably an uplift in quality in print, which suits DNAD very well, actually, is there will be more premium entries for print being an artifact that you wish to hold rather than something that you naturally just consume, like an article. And I think that actually goes well in DNAD's favour. But similarly, all of those skills of creative writing just move into different mediums that are more diverse. Mm-hmm. The concept of blogging as a creative writing platform is almost untapped in DNAD, I think, in that kind of thing. Or what is a magazine anyway? And all those questions I'm sure that you guys Linda and I were just talking about before, actually, will all mean that the skills are still there, they just shift across mediums. Yeah. So the prize of craft, I think, was always sort of well upheld in any medium, I think.
Mm.
But I think it now is... I imagine if you sat in a room with a jury and something of beautiful craft is put into that room in any medium, it stops the jury instantly.
Yes.
And then everyone wants to touch and play. Even if it's an iPad app, actually, when you would just look at the beautiful, simple interaction, people want to touch and play with it, just like you want to pick up a very textured artifact in some way.
Absolutely, and it's important to know that there's a sort of balance in this. So what DNAD seeks to stimulate and then award is great ideas beautifully executed. That's kind of the balance.
Yeah, it's true. I found in my experience of judging that sometimes it comes down to sort of two polar camps within within the little group, and it's, yeah, there's some things that you think that's a really good design, but actually it doesn't convince absolutely everyone. It's one of those things that maybe is too pretty for one side of the room or one side of the table and just doesn't have enough substance, but for the other side, it's, you know, it's a real stylish thing.
I'm not allowed near the judging process because I'm just a boring account executive and not an awarded creative.
Just on the subject of awards, I wondered, Tim, if you could tell us a little bit about the announcement last year of the white pencil and perhaps how that came about.
It's about activating DNAD's and the global creative community, but as access through DNAD to use the power of creativity to change the world. That's, at its simplest, is what it's about. And the white pencil has been established to celebrate the 50th anniversary. It's the first new award in DNAD's history. And we hope, absolutely, we're confident it'll be an ongoing thing. Maybe not every year. That might trivialise it slightly. Maybe every 2 or 3 years, but at a frequency to be determined. And this year we chose a cause, and that cause is the invention, actually, of a very brilliant man called Jeremy Gilley, who's a filmmaker. And his idea was to establish Day of Peace, and that Day of Peace is September the 21st. And he got it unanimously adopted as a resolution of the United Nations. And the role we can play in this is to help him build awareness of an engagement with that great cause. And Andy, you talk about it because you thought of it.
Its origin came from the Call for Entries last year, which Work Club has been sort of fortunate enough to work on. And as we were going through, it's a very functional brief. It has a very clear message to deliver about the entries and the benefits of all of that. But we were looking at it and thinking there's an opportunity here to become much more of a catalyst to an industry. I think awards can be seen as slightly posthumous. Yeah, posthumous to creative in a sense. So they are creatives run, especially ad campaigns and things like that. They've gone and passed and they live in a very kind of transient moment. And yes, the thought of winning an award can spur you forward, but it doesn't actively stand behind you and drive you forward.
Right.
And with the white pencil, the thought was really, can we create something that is a catalyst for ideas, that begins to say, we feel that if as an industry, as creative industries, we have ideas in this direction, we can have a much stronger impact on the future and on the world at large. And also it's just capitalizing on a trend that's obvious, a trend for social concepts and a bit more of a social conscience. I was thinking about people in early 20s, how socially motivated they are. I was into girls, mopeds, and lager, I think, in my 20s. I had no mopeds. I had no social conscience, you know, I just wasn't aware, and I think now they are. And I think White Pencil taps into that. So it came out of the team at Work Club and mostly a creative called Ben Harris pushing through that and trying to figure out the value of an award a little bit in that and trying to say that creative ideas and creative agencies and creative companies can change the world and have a positive impact on the world. And really that's what it does. It's here is an award that says this is for ideas that change the world. And I think that's a brilliant message, whatever medium that you're working in. And it makes every company become accountable for their messaging and for their business and for what they're trying to achieve. And as Tim said for this year, Peace One Day, really it's elevate Peace One Day. Put all of your communications, knowledge and power into Peace One Day and see if we can lift that message. And then Rosie, I believe, put in a fantastic twist that said your work must have run. So it's not just, hey, here's spec stuff. You've got to get it live, which means your client has to be involved as well.
Right.
Or you need a media partner, or you need something, or digitally you need to have enough spin to get it viral. And I think that's the twist that makes it for me, is that you can't just invent an idea. It has to be effective, it has to run, it has to be judged. And that's when the white pencil will judge you on the basis of its strength. So I'm really excited to see what wins, and I'm really excited for the future.
That was Monocle's Richard Spencer-Powell raising a glass at the D&AD headquarters in London, celebrating 50 years of design and art direction. We'll be taking a short break now, but do stay tuned. We're off to Paris to talk menswear next.
For listeners in Tokyo or visitors to Japan, you can now enjoy a coffee, a Wilkinson dry ginger ale, or our classic curry at our first ever Monocle cafe and shop at the new Hankyu Men's Department Store, just steps from Ginza and the lobby of the Peninsula. Featuring a Monocle shop, stocked with our ever-expanding collection of special collaborations, the Monocle Cafe is the perfect place to refuel after a run round the Imperial Palace or a busy day in Marunouchi. For more details, visit monocle.com.
The autumn-winter menswear collections have recently whirled up and down the catwalks of Milan and Paris. It's one thing clicking on style.com to see the latest looks. It's quite another being there in person. As any seasoned showgoer will tell you, the year in fashion is as much about what's shown on the runway as what's said on the street. With this in mind, our New York editor, Aisha Spears, set about hunting down the opinions of the great and good from the Paris shows. And here's what she found.
Men's Fashion Week in Paris is a healthy mix of high-octane catwalk shows from luxury brands and bustling trade shows packed full with smaller brands displaying the latest offerings for the upcoming season. Last week, we were in town to see what was in store for the autumn-winter season 2012. The Chinoy Trade Show is one of our first stops. Held in the grand old Bourse building, the show is decked out with stalls from brands like Hernaud and Chauncey, a Belgian knitwear brand that we first met at the show last year. I stopped by to see what they were up to.
We are Tranoi, showing menswear fall 12-13, and I'm Natalie, the designer.
And I'm David, the other guy.
The everything else.
Yes.
And your label is called?
Our label is called Chauncey. So the name comes from a character from Jerzy Kosinski's novel called Being There. You have to see the movie, by the way. From Al Ashby, 1979 movie, and we love that character so much. It's everything we like, someone simple, elegant, very mysterious.
And funny.
So funny. And it's us, so we named our movie. Maybe we made a movie too.
Yeah.
One day.
Maybe like a movie, yes. Let's do a movie.
But we began with a knitwear collection.
And how many pieces are in this collection?
26 styles, plus maybe 19 accessories, knitted accessories and shoes.
And how have you found this season? How have you found Trinoy and Paris at this time? Is it busy?
And Trinoy, I think it's a cool place to be with the international buyers. But it's quite slow this season. I think it's quite slow, and I think it's because of the shows outside, and they might come later.
First day were good. The accounts we used to have are coming back. Yeah. Some new too.
Great new shops.
Can you mention any of them?
Yes, Merci.
In Paris, yes.
I love Merci.
Thanks to Merci. And
yesterday was opening ceremony too. Le Bon Marché.
How does it work between the two of you? Because you're husband and wife. Tell us a little bit about.
Oh my God.
How is it very stressful or is it very enjoyable?
It's very stressful. It's very enjoyable. And it's very stressful.
Paris's first district contains a warren of streets filled with Japanese restaurants and cafes. Takehiro Sato, our fashion director, and I grabbed a coffee in between shows with some friends from Japanese luggage company Porter.
Yoshida Kaban's design. Kuwahata.
Mr. Kuwahata, he's the designer of Yoshida Kaban, Porter Japan.
Same, Hasegawa Susumu desu.
Susumu Hasegawa from Porter Japan, same designer.
When did you arrive in Paris?
18.
They both arrived on the 18th of January and are leaving tomorrow.
And what do you like seeing in Paris? What are you excited about seeing while you're here?
Judo Pomme とか
They obviously see, you know, the fashion shows such as Comme des Garçons shows. Also, they would like to see Judo Pomme, the museum, and also vintage books stores. That's what they like to see every time in Paris.
And this area of Paris is interesting because it's like so many Japanese restaurants and Japanese people. Is this an area you spend a lot of time in when you come to Paris?
Nomination means Nomi is a Japanese word saying drink. which is combined with communication. They spend a lot of time here for nomination in this district, but during the daytime they prefer to stay or spend time in Saint-Michel. Ato Saint-Michel
Saint-Germain-des-Prés.
Yeah, they sleep here, you know, they have nomination, go to bed, it's easy. Yeah.
That's a really good word.
The Marais is home to a number of showrooms. One of the largest is the Capsule Trade Show, which occupies an empty car garage on the Rue de Turenne. Alongside labels like Woolrich Woolen Mills, London Underground and Monitaly were Grenson Shoemakers. Ted Hutchings, Grenson's brand director, told us about this season's offerings.
The collection's much bigger this season. We've been having a resurgence of the brand over the past few seasons, and we're really pleased with how it's going. We do two things at Grenson. We do things that are very much geared around our heritage and what we've done for a number of years, and try and put a modern-day twist on them. And that seems to be what people are liking at the moment.
So what are the most popular styles at the moment for you guys?
Well, we have a core range of styles that we've built up over the past few years, mainly based around the brogues and our generation of brogues, if you like. But we've tried to do different twists on things over the course of different seasons. So, for example, this season, we've taken our Archie brogue and our Fred brogue boot and put a huge red micro sole on it. We've also introduced the duck boot, which everyone has really loved when we showed that at Pitti this season. And I know the guys just come back from Berlin. They also said it had a really good reaction.
Yeah, that's gorgeous. That's really nice. That's three colourways that it comes
three in. Three colourways of the duck boot, yeah. And also, in addition to that, we've also introduced this other sole that Tim designed, which is two soles put together. We introduced it for spring summer and recolored it for winter, and it kind of looks like a brothel creeper teddy boy kind of shoe. So it's taking very, very simple patterns and putting it on top of this new sole, kind of gives it a new life, really.
And I mean, so you guys were in New York for Capsule, you're in Berlin, bread and butter, and now you're here for Capsule.
Yeah.
How's it gone? How's this? And you're in Pitti. So, how have the trade shows gone for you? Has it been a good year? I mean, what's the market?
Well, I think everyone was slightly concerned. Winter's a big season, especially for us, because we do so many boots and chunky shoes and things like that. What with everything that's going on at the moment, I think we were a little bit concerned, but the reaction's been really positive. And I think people are really interested in looking for new, interesting product. And we love being at Capsule and part of the Capsule family. And we work with them also in Vegas as well, where we show the men's and ladies' collections too. So, yeah, it's a great show for us, and we're surrounded with some fantastic brands.
And what markets are you seeing the most growth in? I mean, what are your kind of core markets at the moment?
Well, we've seen slight growth in the US, which is fantastic. But Europe, in Italy and France certainly as well, have seemed to be jumping back on board with us, which we're really happy about.
So the Italian market for you, why do you think they're increasing their interest in Grenson?
We didn't really have a very huge business there to begin
with. That's quite lucky, it shows growth.
Yeah, exactly. So we were really happy about that. I think what we do at Grenson is we do two things. You know, we offer a product at a certain price, an entry level, which gets people into the brand, a slightly younger customer into the brand, and people can see that and respect that.
That was our New York editor, Aisha Spears, on the streets of Paris, gauging reactions to the new menswear collections. We're sticking around in Paris a little longer, but first, a fitting tune. Here's Paris by Friendly Fires.
One day, we're gonna live in Paris. I promise, I'm on it. When I'm bringing in the money, I promise.
That was Paris by Friendly Fires. And from fashion, via song, to design, it's time to drop in on one of my favourite galleries in the city. Gallery Creo is run by husband and wife team, Didier and Clemence Krentowski. With impeccable and interesting taste, there's nothing this pair don't know about design. Our reporter, Alex Orne, dropped by to hear from Clemence about the things that have shaped her life and career.
Is there anything in this gallery that you would say is your favourite thing? No, it's impossible. No, it's impossible because, you know, it's always the thing that, you know, you have things that you just love because you know them and you have a strong relationship with them. And then the next one and the new one is, of course, you know, when not your favorite, but something you really like. And here in my office, what I really love is that it's a mix. I mean, you have, of course, brand new creations by Zekely, by Borlaug, by Newson, by Charpin, Morrison, but also vintage things. So these are the way we like it also. I mean, it's not about, you know, trying to say that's the good way and there's only one way. No, absolutely not. We believe that you can mix and that's fantastic to put things together and to be free about it. It's not about, you know, again, it's not about a taste. It's really about yourself and things you like and that, you know, brings you something interesting. I think for us, my husband and I think it's very particular because it's really our passion. I mean, we began the gallery working with great designers, maybe the most important living designers now, and we produce pieces. So it's kind of, we have a different look at the pieces, I think. So yeah, the relationship we have with objects are maybe a little different because we know the designers, because we know how to produce them. So it's kind of special. For example, here we're in my office, and of course I have a desk, which I love.
So this desk, is it something special to you?
Yes, it is. First of all, because I do work on this desk, so functionally it works perfectly well for me. It's also special because it's a creation by Martin Zekely, very emblematic of his work, meaning that it's very pure, very simple, and at the same time very strong. On the top of it, as you can see, I have many objects.
How do you think it represents your work?
Well, first of all, because it is by Martin Zekely, it's a person and a designer we've been working with since the very beginning. And this year we were very proud because he had this fantastic exhibition at Pompidou. It's very thin, very pure. I can really work on it. I mean, it's a piece of design for sure, but it's also very functional. And that's what I like about design. What we do at the gallery is basically leave the designers completely free. So they create very pieces that are very special because we don't give them any specification. We don't tell them anything about prices, about materials, about ideas. They really do what they want. So at the end, when you leave a designer completely free, when you give 100% of freedom, is taking this freedom entirely and designing something that you've never seen before.
And how do you relate to this desk? And do you have any anecdote you can tell me about it?
Not really about the piece itself. It's much more, I think, the idea and the fact of being so comfortable working on a piece of somebody. I love the work. But of course, for me, working on a Zekely's desk means a lot, basically. That's the same with the light that I have in my office. It's almost like a star on the top of my head. It's a black light. It's called the black light. It's a ceiling light by the Borlaug brothers. And to me, it's very it's very special because it has always been in my office, and it's kind of a lucky sign, something very very personal at the end.
What do you think this tells us about the way you do things at Creo and the way you do things yourself?
It tells you that when you see such things, you've never seen such things anywhere else because of this freedom the designer have. So it's not, they are not giving an answer to a question that a company would ask. If I would tell them, you know, I would like, I don't know, something very specific for, or if I would give them marketing specifications, and we absolutely do not. So the gallery leaves them completely free, and it's really something that they have in their imagination and they want to create. So yeah, I think the good thing is the surprise you have looking at the piece. But this surprise is not, to me, and that's important, it's not like you're looking at something really totally weird or unknown and you don't guess what it is. Here you absolutely see what it is. I think it's much more the relationship and the way of creating that you see and that we are fighting for at the gallery. So yeah, that tells about what we do actually.
There are quite a lot of objects here. You surround yourself with lots of things.
I'm a sentimental person. I love to keep things. This was given me by Rena Dumas, whom I really, really loved. And she used to, at the end of each year, to do something special. And it was always very poetic. It was kind of a small... I have here... Yeah, I love this one. Look. There's a small Santa in it's just a piece of wood actually. But then she would add, you know, a drawing or a little sculpture or something that would make you, you know, smile. She was like that. So that's really beautiful. That's one of my daughter, you know, these beautiful things that you have for Mother's Day that I had some years ago. No, and I try not to keep too much, you know. To be honest, they are very tiny things. I like it to be discreet because I have many people coming into my office too. So you cannot have your life, you know, on your desk. But yeah, that's true. I really like to be surrounded by personal things that make me think of the person I like, of course. And all these old... I love to keep, you know, these invitation cards. Of course, I love the contemporary side of our work, but I do love the memory also. It's not because you're projected in the future and that you like that you have to forget about your memories or your past. And I love photos. I love keeping, you know, some souvenirs of great moments or dear friends. So yeah, it's a kind of... protection for me, I think, to be surrounded by, you know, persons and objects of people I really love.
That was Alex Orne in Paris with Clemence Krentowski of Gallery Creo. Time now for a short break, but stay tuned. We're boarding a flight to Beijing in a moment.
Monocle editor Andrew Tuck looks at cities around the world and the people, buildings and open spaces that make up the urban landscape. With interviews and discussions of the spaces and places we live in, The Urbanist is your very own urban audio retreat. That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24 and also available on our timeshift player at monocle.com and, of course, on iTunes.
Welcome back to Section D here on Monocle 24. It's no great secret that Chinese design gets a lot of bad press. If it's not sweatshop conditions on the factory floor, then it's lawsuits from Western firms spotting identikit copies of their precious designs. Of course, there's more to design in China than cheap labour and carbon copies. But there's a danger that this clamour of accusation is eclipsing the significant, brilliant, young and traditional design communities. We dispatched our reporter in Beijing, Debbie Mason, to hear the other side.
Luxury furniture buyers in China have recently been troubled by claims that the Asian retailer Da Vinci has been selling so-called Italian imports that were in fact produced in a factory in southern China. Indeed, copying is almost endemic in China. You only have to wander down one of the lines of stalls at the Silk Market in Beijing's Central Business District, and the fake Prada, Gucci and Louis Vuitton practically jump off the rails at you.
Hi, do you need one more bag? Louis Vuitton, Gucci, Prada, Chanel, Hermes, any bag I have, I give good price.
But when it comes to designer furniture, a quiet, homegrown element is starting to appear and showing off its own creative talent without resorting to cheap copies of Western brands. At Beijing's now annual Design Week in October, some of these little-known brands were making their presence felt. Eric Chen is the creative director, and he just had time for a quick chat in a busy cafe on his way to the airport in Beijing.
Yeah, maybe I should just first say that copying is... absolutely like a big bad issue here, but I think some people are a bit excessively scared off by it here, because I think you have to remember, in the sort of grand historical scheme of things, I mean, almost every country in the world in their process of development went through a copying phase. Going back to the turn of the last century, the Americans were accused of copying the Europeans. I found stories from 100 years ago where the French were all in arms because the Germans were copying the French. 30 years ago, Italy was the center of copying and fashion. So I think it's a mistake to think of this as some kind of permanent condition or some inherently Chinese thing. It's a problem.
It's almost a stage that design and creation goes through.
Sure, and there will always be copying in China, just like there continues to be copying in the US and in Europe. I mean, the copying will never go away.
Eric says that some local designers are following traditional paths to arrive at modern designs.
For sure, there's a large group of contemporary designers who are searching for ways to express Chinese ideas in contemporary ways. Again, the results can be very expressive, and they tend to follow in that trajectory of that kind of scholar's object, you know, where you have these sort of organic shapes that not only express the emotions of the creator, but also stir the emotions of the viewer in a sort of contemplative way. I mean, Sun Wentao, who does these fantastic scholar's rocks out of foam, basically. And they've struck a chord. For a long time now, of course, people have played with reinterpreting traditional Chinese motifs. I think there's an acknowledgement that that's been sort of played out. But there is a desire to find a Chinese expression, but without resorting to those kind of cliches that we often see. The dragons and phoenixes are, you know, not everything has to be lacquered red.
Wang Xin, or Simon Wang, is the founder of ACF, a furniture design and production company which currently has one outlet at the trendy 798 Art District, a former factory complex that now houses art galleries, boutiques and cafes. Wang Xin says that ACF, which has 10 designers, is opening a further 6 outlets in China this year. This is a two-piece suite, a coffee table, and two sofas which go together, a kind of beige material cover. And it's very, very thin walnut. Walnut is beautiful. You can really see the grain.
Wood is easy to control. It has very stable properties and it's very beautiful.
This is a screen. It's got coils within the actual screen that flap with breeze and keep a room very cool. It's kind of traditional, but not. It's a modern traditional.
Yes, it's a modern traditional.
Is this fish?
Yes.
And clouds?
Yes.
Yeah.
Before, what would usually happen was that people would give you a diagram and ask if you could make it. It was always about price. But I am not a carpenter. I don't want to be going to factories and asking if they can do it for 10 or 20 RMB less. Now, more and more people are paying attention to individuality, to their own designs. So more and more people are emphasizing taste, character, and quality.
Isabel Pascal is the owner of Wu Hao, a unique curated shop in Beijing that promotes mainly Chinese designers' creations. Wu Hao and its designers had a large presence at the Design Week.
There is Chinese from mainland, but also Chinese from Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, and a lot of Chinese designers who are based in London, New York.
So do you think that there is more of a design concept now in China just coming out?
I think it's like a kind of freshness, which is kind of amazing. These people are very young, they are very fresh, they are very talented, and they are looking about what is being a Chinese designer in the contemporary world. So they mix in a way which is very interesting. I'm sure that the world is ready for the Chinese designers. People are waiting. I can see my clients, both Chinese and foreigners. They really want to see something about Chinese design. They want to see emerging ideas. And here at Wu Hao, what we are doing is that my will is really to help them to grow and to become part of the design world. And they started to do this.
Beijing Design Week director Eric Chen again.
The furniture business is tough, no matter where you are, especially for young designers. Young designers have a tough time getting their work produced and marketed and sold. And that's especially true in China, where the market is still fairly young. I mean, it's growing very, very quickly. And just in the 3 years I've been here, the interest in design has really exploded. But I wouldn't say, you know, there's a huge, thriving, you know, contemporary furniture scene. It's on the brink.
Are we likely to see these Chinese labels being exported in the same way that Western brands are imported?
I think seeing big-name Chinese brands abroad is absolutely inevitable. It's funny, you know, when I first moved to Beijing, in Chinese design, there was almost nothing 3 years ago. And now, you know, there's You've got trade shows, exhibitions, magazines, designers popping up, new companies, new stores focusing on Chinese design. The past 3 years have seen phenomenal growth, and I think it's definitely worth seeing what happens in the next 3 years.
Who knows? Maybe retailers like DaVinci will be stocking a few made-in-China brands in the not-too-distant future that won't also carry a stigma along with the made-in-China label. Debbie Mason for Monocle in Beijing.
I've just returned from the annual IMM fair in Cologne. It's the first furniture fair on the global circuit and the main one for the German, Austrian and Swiss markets. This year, presumably owing to the much publicised strength of the German economy, it was bigger than ever. 1,157 companies showed from 54 countries. And after 2 days trawling the stands of the fairgrounds, here are the top things I took away from the experience. Natural wood has been the material of choice by furniture manufacturers for some time now. But this year, hard-edged corners on tables and chairs have been planed and sanded into tactile curves. Everyone, everywhere, rubbed their hands over these satisfying beveled edges. A display of craftsmanship and suggestion that while consumers don't want everything upholstered like it was 5 years ago, they're also a bit tired of banged elbows and shins. Block colour still reigns, but this year the two tones on top are orange and purple. The less said about this, the better. Please don't buy these, and with any luck, this trend will soon disappear. Smaller living spaces means smaller, cleverer furniture, and designs with multiple functions were everywhere to be found. From standard things like bookcases with pull-down desks and beds that roll away to reveal storage, there were also cupboards that opened to reveal kitchens, bathrooms, and just about anything else you can hide behind a door. If your furniture can't fold away and perform at least three functions, it frankly doesn't cut it. Finland, Romania, Greece, Russia and Portugal were just five of the numerous countries with first-time showers at Cologne. There were numerous companies from Turkey and Poland too, and buyers were in abundance from Russia, Scandinavia, France and Italy. Cologne, usually a rather local fair for business, has exploded. Everyone wants a piece of Germany's strong consumer spend, it seems. So often overlooked at trade fairs, lunch is what keeps people going. And the Cologne fairground has nailed it. Three types of Wurst, Frankfurter or sausage, delicious potato salad and horseradish cream. What more could you ask for? I could eat this every day of the week. What Cologne offers for lunch, though, it lacks come evening time. The very best furniture fairs take advantage of the international crowds that flood in. The social element is what people remember. Dinners, parties, even after-parties are needed to seal business deals and make people think, this is fun, I'm coming again next year. The Cologne Furniture Fair may be great by day, but it's missing a bit of social lubricant after dark. And in a city with wonderful independent nooks and crannies, this could easily be rectified. I'm supposed to be moderately impartial when it comes to favouritising designers. But when it comes to furniture, I can't help it. I'm addicted to Finn Juhl. The mid-century Danish furniture designer is something of a mystery to most people. And to many of those who are familiar with his work, he's considered something of an oddity. This year, Mr. Juhl would be 100. And even fewer people would be aware of his work were it not for the dogged determination of a German husband and wife team. Martina Munk and Manfred Werner have a shop in Hamburg called Von Kultur 66, and they've made it their mission to bring Finn Juhl into the spotlight. I dropped by their latest exhibition of Juhl's work in the Chelsea Hotel at the Cologne Furniture Fair last week to hear how and why they love the old master so much.
In 2001, I was ill and at home, and my husband went to the Cologne Furniture Fair. And there were those Danish guys standing, very lonesome and very unhappy because nobody wanted to talk to them. And they felt so unhappy. And husband came back and told me, I've seen a Finn Juhl pelican chair and was totally out of himself. And actually, at that time, nobody liked it because it's from 1940. And people are not used to 40s design. All the 40s pieces you can have, like Prouvé or Charlotte Perriand, are very rare. And the thing is, people are not used to that design with the fat legs.
Yeah.
That's the problem. Because after the war, they went back to a style before the war. So it was never in the households, it was never in the magazines. You can find it in some books, but on very important auctions for thousands and thousands and thousands. Hundred thousands,
yeah.
Because there were only a few pieces, and Finule hasn't been produced over all the rest of the century. And there is a Finule Foundation in Denmark, and they take care that the pieces are handcrafted in Denmark, and the wood pieces nowadays in Japan, which is even more expensive than Denmark, but they make it so wonderful. And the thing is, we had to establish it totally from the beginning. And I had people standing there and saying, oh, that's a funny chair, but it has fat legs. And
a strange shaped back.
It would be better if it would be a swan, Arne Jacobsen. Arne Jacobsen would be better. I don't want this one.
What was it that you liked about the piece that other people maybe hadn't seen?
No, it's so unique. It's so art. He was very, very into art and all his forms. The thing was, the Danish didn't like the forms also all the time.
Yeah, and he was working totally unusual in with different ways. So he was not hooked on any mass production or having something like a big seller or whatever. So he
never had to do something everybody likes. He just did what he liked, you know.
Yeah.
No discussion about design. We just saw somewhere, we saw an interview with it, I think it was Jasper Morrison, saying that nowadays design is made with the help of discussions, and I'm so happy, Finn, you never discussed anything. would have been 100 this year, and all over Denmark, they are all everywhere. There are exhibitions in the museums, and Copenhagen, for example, in the Design Museum in Copenhagen. And
Kunstindustriemuseum, they are showing the drawings, most of his drawings.
And the Trapholt Museum is making
and Kolding is
an exhibition, and the Ordrupgar Museum is making an exhibition only with the new pieces, the new produced pieces, not with vintage pieces. The thing is, I think I didn't make that clear, most of the vintage pieces are so expensive because the Pelikan chair, he made four of them in 1940. And the last one at Philips was a $57,000, and the last one, which was on auction in Denmark, was over €80,000. And the wall sofa was at Miami Basel last year.
$120,000.
He made a lot of designs, and peu à peu, to say it so, piece by piece, we tried to find a new piece which the Danish like to reproduce.
Yeah, the first moment we came here to the Chelsea Hotel, this was in 2004, we had problems for filling up one room because we had two couches, one armchair, and one coffee table, and it was unbelievable.
Oh,
today
that was fun. We came with an old Finule bed, which belongs to one of the Danish producers,
yeah.
And not to spend too much money, we slept in it.
Tried and tested.
Yes.
It's not in production. So today, I would say something like 60% of the collection we are showing here. Some pieces have to stay in Hamburg because we cannot show everything. Then we have to rent out, I don't know, see three suites or whatever for showing it all. So the interest is really tremendous on Finule.
But it's still people who are into art and who are interested in good qualities. The qualities are so amazing because it's All the furniture is built like it has been built in the 40s, with no modern things going on there, no new ideas of how to produce it, you know. There are so many pieces who go, old designs who go back to production, and that's companies who sit there and say, oh, how can we make it a bit lighter, a bit cheaper, and just a tiny little bit, and in the end it's all crap, you know.
It does, it destroys the quality and the character made it special in the first place. So how will you celebrate Finule's 100th anniversary?
We will have a party in Hamburg in May, and I think it will be the 5th
or the 12th.
We are not quite sure about that, but we will have a nice party in Hamburg and the old slaughterhouse.
Raise a martini glass.
Yes, definitely. 2 or 3 or something.
That was the wonderful cackle of Martina Munk and her husband Manfred Werner of Von Kultur 66 in Cologne. And that brings us to the end of today's episode of Section D. We'll be back next week with a wobble through the world of jelly and design and a spot of luxury bikini spotting in Brazil. So don a thong, grab a spoon and tune in then. This week's show was produced by Gillian Tobias, our researcher was Thea Erdahl, and it was masterfully edited by Holly Fisher. I'm Hugo MacDonald. Thank you for listening.